Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The war in Ukraine is now 7 days old, and thousands on both sides have died. More than 1 million people have left the tiny country southwest of Russia, creating a humanitarian crisis. But why should the war over there be of such great concern over here? Well, tonight we break down the critical issues. My guests are Dr. Clarence Lussain, political science professor at Howard University, and Dr. David Cairns, expert on Russian history and politics and author of the book Mind and Labor on the Farm in Black Earth, 1861 to 1914. If you have comments or questions about the conflict in Ukraine right now, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Cairns, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Good evening.
And Dr. Lussain, always good to have you on the program.
Yes, thank you.
So let me ask the obvious question, Dr. Lussain. Why should America care about this conflict between Russia and Ukraine? I'm sure that prior to several weeks ago, most Americans would not have been able to find Ukraine on the map.
So that's a great question, and I'm glad to be on with the other guests. I think there are multiple answers, and I won't go into too much detail. But first, I think there's just the humanitarian side of it, that unprovoked invasion by Russia has led to a harsh devastation. And we're seeing it, just a small smidgen of it, in terms of the bombs that are dropping on civilians. That are not just whatever military targets may be in sight. It's civilians that are feeling the brunt of all of this. This is why, as you mentioned, there's 1 million people in a week who have left the country for safety. I have actually friends in Ukraine, and I've been in touch with them. Most have stayed, but they're terrified, and they're constantly running to bomb shelters. Beyond that, though, Russia has violated international law under the United Nations Charter, as well as other provisions in the UN, including the International Declaration of Human Rights. These are violations. It's also violating European law. Russia is not, the Russian Federation is not a member of NATO or the European Union, but it is a member of the Council of Europe. And under the European Court, European Charter of Human Rights, is violating a number of different policies. And so just at the level of the international community cannot tolerate this kind of violation. And then lastly, I would mention, even if people in the United States are absent on those other two issues, there's a redounding effect by this problem of Russia and its impact on energy around the world. And so it's going to come back to the United States, and we're going to feel it. So there are multiple reasons, I think, why people in this country should be paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cairns, let's talk a little bit about the history. If you could give me the cliff notes on why we continue to see this European superpower upset the deck. This is the biggest conflict since World War II. And yet it seems that for the most part, and I could be wrong, I'm not an expert, obviously, on European history, but I would argue that since World War II, despite the Cold War and other, rumblings, Russia seems to be the troublemaker. Why does that appear to be the case?
Well, the Russian point of view, which I'm not going to advocate, but let me try to explain.
Sure, go ahead.
Thinking is where they're coming from, is that since 1991, when they forswore communism, which did at least have a dimension of an ideology which aspired to expansion across the globe to free the working classes, et cetera. They forswore this in 1991, and they expected that the world would reward them with partnership status in Europe in terms of a new security architecture and on the international stage in general. And they really believed they didn't get that. So it was their understanding that NATO didn't have any longer a justification. It was set up to oppose the USSR and the Warsaw Pact coalition of forces. And with that extinguished, they expected NATO would exit the stage or certainly not come closer to Russia. It has. They've been excluded. Well, they've been excluded largely from the adjudication of international affairs. They're also feeling that they were not given the sort of economic assistance or understanding, or they were subjected to a variety of prejudices, and those prejudices have not ceased in recent years, such that they feel they're on the defensive. So we can call Russia a troublemaker, but they would point to Ukraine in particular as a drastic provocation against them in 2014, when the Ukrainian government, duly elected, maybe corrupt, but duly elected, was driven from power, clearly with the support and encouragement of the West, including the U.S., and a new government came into power which was overtly anti-Russian. And from that point, Ukraine and Russia were inevitably going to be in conflict because the Ukrainian population is partly Russian ethnic and speaking and sentiment in terms of sort of political allegiance even. That's changed over time. The current president was elected largely with Russian territories in the East who voted for him, in fact. So the Russian population in Ukraine doesn't really welcome Putin's invasion, which is a drastic step and unforgivable catastrophe. But the Russian position is that as of 2014, they were very much the defender, and they felt that it was very ominous that NATO was coming closer to them, and that through some coalition or some combination of or machinations, that they were vulnerable to being undermined. Not simply the Putin regime, but that the West would be happy to cannibalize and dismember them. And they've seen other parts of the world. In fact, they've seen their own country felt cannibalized and dismembered. The Soviet Union was dismembered, and the economy was stripped and sold off. So they have some background from not just psychological, but some reasonable concern about encroachment from the West in a context where they're not given the right to participate in the security architecture.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the conflict in Ukraine. What is it about, and why should America care about the conflict there? If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jay, calling from Germantown. Thanks for calling, Jay. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you very much to give me this opportunity to say thank you to America and thank you to everybody, entire world, for to support the Ukraine. My brother is still right now in Kyiv, the center of the capital, with the wife and kids. I talk to them every single day, sometimes twice a day. But today, I find out when I was communicating with him, I find out his voice is a little bit weaker because it takes too long for him. So difficult. We don't know how to take him out. He can get out. But sometimes when I communicate with him, I find out he was talking about if U.S. can help them or NATO can help them to cover an airspace, they can deal with a ground system because they're more powerful in ground system. Even the Russian people, all those military, they're very, very young. They're 20 years old, 18 years old, and they don't know what they're doing. Some live again out, and they don't have the food. They're feeding them. They help them, and they ask them to get out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some are backing up, they just get out. Some leave a weapon and just sit down and eat because they don't have the food.
Well, Jay, let me see if either one of our guests can a comment on what you've shared with us, because I think you've given us a little more detail, which is aligned with some of the reporting that we have seen over the past 7 days from big news agencies. And I appreciate your phone call. Thank you so much. So about what Jay has shared, Dr. Lussain, it appears that Russia militarily is attempting to put a stranglehold on supplies and transportation and the like, which is kind of standard fare when you're talking about military conflict. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and that is consistent with what I'm hearing from people that I've been talking to over there. Just to step back for a little second, the other guest mentioned what happened in 2014, and that's really important. Part of what Putin is arguing is around this threat he's feeling from NATO. And four of the seven countries that border Ukraine are members of NATO, Poland, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia. But there's also the issue around EU, and that's really what led to a crisis in 2014. The president at that time, President Yushchenko, Yanukovych, who was flirting with joining the EU, irritated Putin, to say the least. Putin made a counteroffer. The president then reneged on the deal, and that's what sent people into the street, into Maidan Square, in January and February 2014. That ultimately led to, after the president basically attacked people in the square, and in a couple of days, over 100 people died. That's when that president was basically voted out of office and fled to Russia. And then the next day is when Russia took Crimea. And I was in Ukraine shortly after that. I was there in the spring when the war broke out in the east. And part of what the caller is talking about is the attacks that began to happen on and people who were trapped in the east. As many people know, the country Ukraine is somewhat split, where parts of the east are Russian descent in many ways. People speak Russia all over the country, so it's not that much of a language. But the western part of Ukraine is very much not just pro-Ukraine, but very much anti-Russian. And so all of those dynamics are kind of playing themselves out. And Putin has framed it now as Russia, Ukraine should not even exist, that these are Russian people, just as he says the people in Belarus, and so they basically have no legitimacy to a government or to a state. And so this attack is kind of coming all-sided. Many people believe that this is to basically remove the current government. So what the caller is talking about is an all-out assault. This isn't a surgical effort to take certain parts, but to me it appears it's an effort to choke the entire country. And Putin's position is either we will have a compliant Ukrainian government, or we will have a country that's destabilized and degraded to the point of uselessness.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the conflict in Ukraine. Why should we care about that conflict there, here in the United States? If you have a comment or question, give us a call. Let's go to Omar calling from D.C. Omar, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
All right. Thank you so much for taking my call. You know, I was in Europe several times, back in and out, and I was in Ukraine and Kiev. I just felt like the European had this mentality there will never be a war in Europe, like they were heading toward a different direction, where Russia was just basically arming themselves. My question, was there a failure in the intelligence to assessing Putin and his intention?
Say that last part again.
Was there an intelligent failure in assessing Putin's intention? Because if the CIA knew that he's bound on invading Ukraine, they probably would join NATO, they would join EU to protect him. Would they not take in his intention very seriously? I don't know whether that's an intelligence failure or not.
That's a very interesting question. Mr. Cairns, I've got a minute before the break. I'll let you have that.
I'd say the American intelligence community was spot on in identifying the inevitability and imminence of a Russian invasion, so they knew it was coming. They probably felt they didn't have time to really change the defensive structure quickly enough to have Ukraine become a NATO member. We don't have a military alliance with Ukraine, so we didn't really have any more to do to deter Putin unless we were going to commit an army there, which risks World War III. But I think the intelligence community did spot it, and they didn't underestimate Putin, I don't think.
Thank you so much, Omar, for that question. We need to take a break, but Jerome calling from Colombia, we're going to be talking to you next, so please do not hang up. And don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on our website, whur.com, or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone, and you can hear the program live in its entirety. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking about the war in Ukraine, now a week old. Thousands have died. There is a humanitarian crisis, and there is no end in sight. Tonight, we are breaking down and trying to answer the question, why should we care about this conflict in Ukraine? My guests are Dr. Clarence Lussain, political science professor at Howard University, and David Cairns, expert on Russian history and politics, and the author of the book Mind and Labor on the Farm in Black Earth, 1861 to 1914. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jerome, thanks for hanging on. Calling from Colombia, what's on your mind?
Well, I hear in the news a lot, could anything have been done to stop the conflict? And I wonder about that because, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States was willing to go to war rather than to have missiles placed in its backyard. Is Russia not facing the exact same situation? And that, hey, NATO was created as a military institution to defend against Russia. One of Putin's biggest concerns was Ukraine joining NATO. And so I wonder, could the United States have given assurances to Russia that missiles will not be brought into its backyard? Could that have prevented this conflict?
I'll let both of you jump in on that, but I'll start with you, Dr. Lussain.
Yeah, so I think there are legitimate questions about the utility and whether NATO should actually exist or not. But I think that's very different from Russia launching an unprovoked assault, a murderous, horrendous, brutal assault on Ukraine. And the history of it, there was a statement back in 2008 coming out of one of the NATO meetings where there was it stated that, it supported the aspirations of Ukraine joining NATO. But the reality is that there's almost no possibility that Ukraine was going to be in NATO at any point in the foreseeable future. There's lots of opposition with NATO, and there were other reasons. And so Putin knew that as well. And it had been privately conveyed to Putin and to Russia on many occasions. But it's more useful for Putin to make the argument that Ukraine was going to be this new front line, and then to use that to justify, as well as these other reasons, why he should invade. But the Ukraine in NATO story has a lot of holes in it.
Mr. Cairns.
Yeah, thank you, Jerome, for that question. I think the U.S. and the West and Ukraine had an opportunity to forestall this invasion, or at least to try, by, in fact, rhetorically giving Putin what he wants. Sure, it was not likely that Ukraine isn't, that Ukraine can be part of NATO. They don't meet the requirements to become part of NATO. And Europeans don't want to have a liability of that being forced to defend Ukraine in case they get into a shooting war with Russia. But what if we had just said to Putin, all right, fine, we guarantee Ukraine will not be part of NATO. Would that have stopped or stayed his hand? Maybe. At the very least, it would have made him look even worse had he invaded when we just met his primary condition for continuing dialogue. So I think you make a good point that we could have told him, all right, we guarantee we won't put NATO in Ukraine and we won't have missiles there. Remember, the United States went berserk when Khrushchev decided to put missiles in Cuba. We already had them in Turkey. I mean, the Russians are saying, if it's good enough for you to forbid missiles on your border, isn't it good enough for us? So I think that would have been a deft move. But maybe the U.S. and the West has something else in mind. They goaded Russia into doing this, Putin into doing this. Putin's doing it for himself, too. He wants to eliminate any part of liberal democracy or liberal politics on his borders. He doesn't want Russians to get the idea they can do this. That's part of the story. It's Putin's personal power. But if we had sort of stopped him, maybe we wouldn't get the benefits now. Look at the benefits here. Russia is getting reduced to a pariah state. Their economy will never recover for a long time. Their future is as dark as can be. Their currency has been hit by a dirty bomb, economic dirty bomb. And now we've got what? International corporations are lining up to be part of sanctions. NATO is reinvigorated. We can go on. In other words, the victories, the tangible victories that have been inflicted against Russia now are just enormous. Whereas if we'd appeased them and stopped this war in Ukraine, maybe there wouldn't be burning of all kinds of buildings and torture and suffering right now. So I'm not accusing the West of cynically orchestrating all this, but I can easily envision a scenario where they appease Putin, say, all right, we guarantee no NATO. There wouldn't be a war.
Mm. Yeah, I just got to believe that if anything, they could have stalled what's happening right now by giving him some certainty or at least discussing and entertaining the thought of not having Ukraine join NATO.
You and I would try.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think from a layman's observation, Vladimir Putin is not one who is interested in compromise. And if you think about it, this situation has moved really, really quickly, whether you call them regions, provinces in eastern Ukraine, where he signed those papers, what it was Wednesday a week ago, essentially calling those independent regions, and then the next day, boom, the attack started. This happened very, very quickly, not to mention the propaganda war that has been waged during the course of this. But Jerome, thank you so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. James, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, James. What's on your mind?
Thank you. You actually did a perfect segue. Are you gentlemen aware of any legitimacy of the claims of neo-Nazi activity within the Ukrainian government? Thank you.
Great. That's a great question. Anyone want to take a shot at that?
Go ahead.
So as a general statement, there are far right neo-Nazi elements all across Europe, including in Ukraine, including in Russia. So these elements absolutely do exist. But they, Ukraine, that is not what's what determines or defines the Ukrainian government, as Putin has said. And in fact, the far right extremists are in the east. And one of the things that happened in 2014 when the crisis broke out and in Luhansk and Donetsk, these separatists, pro-Russian separatists rose up. One of the things they did was to go after African students who were in the region. And there were kidnappings, there were film beatings. It got so bad that at one point the Nigerian government sent a train to get people out of the region. But those attacks were coming from far-right forces that were in the east. And one of the groups that I worked with in Ukraine is called the Africa Center that was doing a lot of work around immigrant rights and rights of people of African descent. And one of their main focus was on this far-right extremist pro-Russia groups that were emerging in the east. Now, there are far-right forces on the west side of Ukraine as well. And so they've also been active. But it isn't just kind of a one size, and Putin's characterization of the Ukrainian government is just wrong.
Mm. Mr. Camerons, did you have a comment that you wanted to make?
No, I think it's important to notice the human rights posture on both sides is very weak and deficient. Or rather, you can find ugly examples on both sides. But I accept that most Russians will accept that the Ukrainian government has not been driven by ethnic hatred.
Mm. James, thank you so much for your question. I want to go back to the point that you were discussing, Dr. Lusane, because yesterday and even today, there have been more reports of mistreatment of Africans as well as other people of color in Ukraine who are attempting to leave the country and heading to Poland, being taken off of trains, not being allowed. The EU held a press conference on yesterday, calling it fake news. I think that was a poor choice of terms, considering where we are. But that notwithstanding, your thoughts about these reports and where are we when we talk about, you know, the validity of these reports and what the EU is saying?
So there's a lot of moving parts here. So in terms of the EU and the Ukrainian government, they both have responded to these reports of this mistreatment of not only people of African descent, but people of color from other parts of the world that are in Ukraine and trying to get out. The EU just agreed to implement what it calls the Temporary Protective Directive, which is to have countries that are part of the EU essentially get rid of their normal requirements for letting people in, and that Ukrainians and people with residency in Ukraine would be able to basically easily get through these borders. Now, that doesn't really kind of cover everybody. You've got people who are not in those categories in Ukraine, and that disproportionately would be people of color and people of African descent. So there are lots of African governments that have responded. The African Union has responded. And in the last couple of days, there's been some differences and easing of people being able to get out, particularly where the bottlenecks were in and around Poland. It was easier for people going through Romania, but through Poland and to some degree through Hungary, it was much more difficult. Now, part of all of this, and you know this as media, is there's lots of news coming from all kinds of sources, lots of stuff on social media, and so it's difficult to sort through all of what's accurate and what's, quite frankly, disinformation, as well as who are the sources of this disinformation. So I've been working with a number of different groups trying to, you know, sort through what actually is accurate and what really doesn't not need to be amplified, because there's just no way to kind of verify in the chaos of war that exists right now.
Mm. Mr. Cairns, gas prices are high and have been increasing significantly since the sword rattling between Russia and Ukraine. As an American, what other kinds of concerns might we have that would force your average American to to be concerned about what's going on the other side of the world?
The prospect of inflation and crimping of standard of living has been on the radar of Americans for over a year. I think the price of oil was 41 a year ago. Reached 90 before the shooting started here. So it's not merely this conflict which is to blame. And I think average American family is spending an extra $385 a month because of inflation. This is partly the consequence of all the spending which our governments, the successive ones, have undertaken in keeping the economy sort of juiced up during COVID. It's also easy to argue that the American financial system has been treated like a piggy bank where the money keeps coming and it ends up popping up the stock market so people who are wealthy get ridiculously wealthy. We can make that criticism on another show. So the conflict here in particular is going to have immediate effect on energy prices, on inflation. It's not clear it'll have that many other carry-on effects, but we don't really know because we're in new territory. There's never been an economic sort of dirty bomb dropped on a country like we just dropped on Russia. Even the Nazi German regime did not get deplatformed entirely from banking. So we're in uncharted territory, and I'm not one who's afraid of cyber attacks from Russia. If they had great cyber capabilities, they would have already been using it against the Ukrainians, and they've been pretty feeble at that. So luckily, we don't seem to have a fear of some widespread catastrophic cyber attack. I think Russia has much more to fear than we do in that regard. For instance, what if Apple and Samsung decide to disable all Russian cell phones? They could do it, flip them a switch. So I'm told, send an automatic update. Now, we're not going to do that because that's just torturing the Russian average Joe. But what we've already done is unprecedented, really. And Russia's prepared for that, and they're trying to skirt it, and maybe they'll survive it, sort of. But they're going to be tarred by this, you know, catastrophically for a long time. What, in terms of our way of life, I don't foresee it's going to be easy for me to say right now. I don't see anything drastic apart from higher commodity prices, which will filter through. Mm. Not just gas. There's going to be more. So standard of living is a bit shaky here. It's more interesting what's going to happen if somehow the U.S. establishment commits more resources, military resources, somehow comes into contact with Russia militarily. And the prospect of a horrifying war of bloody mass casualties is going to be an emotional trauma for all of us. And will we withstand the urge to jump in and play savior? I kind of think we should. I don't see Russia, even Putin in his weirdness, his craze for power and his own fear over his own possibility of ending up like Gaddafi. I don't foresee him attacking other countries. It's not really on his radar, from all I can tell. So I would hope for some de-escalation, and I would hope that the U.S. would help to broker a peace deal. Well, Ukraine's going to have to make some big concessions in that case. That's a hard pill to swallow.
Well, I was about to ask, if Ukraine falls, should Moldova be concerned? Should Romania be concerned? Should Hungary, Slovakia, Poland be concerned? These countries in the order I mentioned them to the southwest and to the southwest and the immediate west of Ukraine.
Well, I will tell you instantly no, because a lot of those countries are NATO countries, and Putin has not indicated the desire to instigate hot conflict with NATO. And he hasn't expressed any interest in taking non-Russian territory. He's pointedly pointed out that Ukraine is a brother nation of the Russians. He doesn't feel like he's occupying an enemy people if he advances to Ukraine, even as the Ukrainian-speaking part. But Romania, Moldova, Slovakia, this is really an alien idea. It doesn't issue from anything Putin has said in the past.
I would imagine that there are some dead Ukrainians who would disagree with that.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Dr. Lusain?
Yeah, so I think the NATO has needs to hold its weapons in the U.S. So there definitely needs to be a diplomatic resolution to this crisis. There's no need for any more militarizing of what's going on. What's a potential dilemma in all of this, however, if there is credible evidence of genocide or massive war crimes, then
there's a hard choice that has to be made. And that choice is, do you essentially let this happen because the danger of escalating beyond what anybody wants is real, but also people are dying. And so, you know, this is the, you know, why there needs to be aggressive diplomacy right now. There really does need to be a ceasefire. They haven't agreed on that, but, you know, there are talks going on, and there needs to be both back channel as well as very public-facing pressure to bring this to an end, because the longer it goes, the degradation in Ukraine and in Russia and likely spillover, you know, is really, really, really problematic.
Okay, and so let's talk about that. And I think, you know, Mr. Karen's kind of touched on this just a little bit, but, you know, Dr. Lusain, I'll start with you. As it relates to the political and economic isolation that has already taken place over the past 4 or 5 days, the shutting down of the banks, the devaluation of the ruble, the shutting down of the Russian stock market, the attack on the oligarchs. I want to talk about that a little bit too, but more broadly, if this begins to impact the average Russian so severely, are we talking about I hate to even mention this, another Bolshevik revolution? I mean, is that a possibility?
It's possible, but very, very, very unlikely. There is a very strong anti-war movement, or let me say, there's an anti-war movement in Russia, and we've seen it manifest itself even in the face of harsh retaliation. And there's a anti-Putin movement in Russia as well, but they're very weak. And at this point, there's almost no possibility that, at least in the foreseeable future, that Putin will fall. He still has support of oligarchies. He still has control of the military and the police. So much of that leadership spent the last 2 years trying to sanction-proof themselves from the sanctions they knew would come based on where Putin was headed. But there is discord. And the longer this goes on and the increasing international collective response, that could really have an impact. We're seeing nobody thought the sanctions would be as strong as they have been. No one thought that the Germans would get on board as quick as they did. No one thought even the Swiss, talking about joining the European Union, or at least you're joining in on the sanctions. And so the rally has been somewhat amazing and something going forward we should look at, because there are going to be a lot of other people, there are going to be a lot of other refugees from other places that aren't in Europe that are going to need support and are going to need assistance. And so, you know, there's going to be a need to see as we go forward that there's some equity in support for people who are in crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cairns, your thoughts?
Yeah, on what's going to happen in Russia here, I think there's a danger of pursuing these sanctions without a clear explanation to Russia and the world of what's going to be necessary to remove them. Otherwise, and I'm quoting from a professor named Dresner, who's an expert on sanctions, he writes, otherwise, all this behavior is an exercise in maximizing economic pain of ordinary Russians without any conception of what that will achieve. It could achieve a Russian populace that embraces the demented imperial ambitions that Putin embodies. So there's one real problem with the way we're doing sanctions. If it's indiscriminate, if it's just sort of ferocious, and we don't offer the Russian servants an explanation of how we're going to get out of that, he's saying, he's the expert on sanctions, that we're risking not a overthrow of the Putin regime, but something much worse, where support for Putin will actually mushroom. We're also looking at a Russian elite that is characterized by a friend of mine, another scholar, said negative selection. In other words, you can't really find a leader in there who's going to run a revolt. So the idea that Putin's going to be overthrown, that seems fanciful. I think
right.
I agree on that.
And I think, again, from a layman's perspective, I think what you just shared is fascinating because, and help me here with, you know, my basic knowledge of this. Okay, these sanctions, no matter how broad they are and how deep they are designed to stop the war. Okay, so Putin pulls back. And I think what you're asking or suggesting is, okay, Putin pulls back, but when do you pull back the sanctions? Do you pull them back as quick as you leveled them? Do you wait a month? Do you wait a year? Do you wait 2 years? Do you keep them to punish Putin and, by default, Russia for this horrific war? And what could happen the longer those sanctions remain in place, even if Putin were to decide today to just pull everybody out? How am I doing?
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to me. Who are the oligarchs? Most laymans, when you think oligarchs, you think of, some guy in a James Bond movie with a bad Russian accent. But... you know, who are they, Dr. Lussain? Where does their money come from, and why have they been portrayed as so significant to Putin and this crisis?
Well, I think Dr. Cairns could probably give a kind of better history of that. You know, they come out of the fall of the Soviet Union, and in that mishmash, you begin to get a number of folks who had been in and around the top leadership of the party who then begin to take over the government. And it creates, a whole range of folks. But I'll leave it to Dr. Cairns.
Dr. Cairns, please.
Well, I think the emphasis on the oligarchs is an artifact of the press. Not that they're not, they're easy targets. And they're sort of spectacular distortions of what a society should be. And they reflect criminality in Russian society and corruption, but they're not really political players. I mean, some of them have even come out astonishingly and questioned whether this war is possible and hoping it'll stop. But we can't count on them to stop it, and penalizing them is not really going to change the trajectory of history. They've got so much money they don't know what to do with it. So I don't think the oligarchs are the key here. Putin's the key. He's interested in himself and his regime more than he is in the Russian people. But in his mind, he's defending Russia against, to repeat, dismemberment and cannibalization from a Western economic occupation, which Russia did suffer after 1991. So that's his perspective. If he were to be removed, I don't think it would come from one of the oligarchs. I mean, you'd think it would come from the military, the KGB. Let me return to this idea of negative selection. The people that have made it up to the top are not the type that are going to run that kind of revolt. Yeah.
Are all the oligarchs criminal entities? Where does the money come from?
This came from the middle of the 1990s when Russia had to decide what it would do with its industrial base. The Soviet Union had built its people, the party organizations, and the government had built enormous industrial installations. And they had to decide how to privatize them. And in the process, people with connections and power and organized crime took them for themselves. And that is, at bottom, a criminal activity. That was the product of the entire national state, the Soviet effort. And instead of devolving to the people in some level, in some way, it ended up in the hands of very few people. So that's where you get the oligarch structure. Now, some of them would claim, I did honest business for a while. There's something to it.
Mm. Final thoughts from you, Dr. Lussain.
So I do think that the pain will grow as long as the war continues. We're going to see it, and Europe is going to see it, particularly in terms of Russian gas. Ukraine, about three-quarters of its gas comes from Russia. But then you get to the Baltic states, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, even all the way up to Finland. You're talking 100% of their energy resources coming out of Russia. And then as you head west to Hungary, Slovakia, and even this is why Germany was a big question, because about a third of its gas is coming out of Russia. So it is not going to be isolated between Russia and Ukraine. It will have regional impact and global impact. So it is urgent that we, again, also with the humanitarian crisis, that this comes to an end as soon as possible.
Final thoughts from you, Mr. Cairns.
I think we're entering uncharted territory for both Russia and Ukraine. We have no idea what this peace, no clear idea how this peace is ever going to be resolved. It's not going to end even once it's signed. And the whole Russian population is looking at decades of ostracism. It's really a catastrophe for them. So thoughts go out to both those countries.
Dr. Clarence Lussain, David Cairns, thank you both for talking to us. I really appreciate your insight and the information. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, March 3rd. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.